Hello there, and welcome to the newest episode of Musings on Golf, where great storytelling is what we do each and every week. I'm Kelly Elbin, along with Bob Bupka, the voice of golf for Talk Sport in the UK. And today, we'll be joined by the terrific golf writer, Pete McDaniel, who co-authored two books with Tiger and his dad, Earl Woods, as well as writing at length about the plight of African-American golfers in the 20th century in his remarkable book, Uneven Lies, The Heroic Story of African-Americans in Golf. Robert, got a lot to discuss today with the need to really hurry it up on the PGA Tour, the return of Scottie Scheffler and Rory McIlroy this week at Pebble Beach, and finally, a TGL thriller last night. But first up is Pete McDaniel, who you've known for a long time, and I know for whom you have great respect.
You're right about that, Kelly. I think Pete is one of the most respected golf writers that we've ever had, in his words and in his actions and in his deeds. Pete McDaniel is the perfect example of the type of person that we love having in the golf business and, of course, really love having him on Musings on Golf.
Yeah, and Pete's a fascinating guy. Grew up playing golf at a time when golf for blacks in this country was not the easiest way to enjoy 4 hours in a given day. Pete went on really to be a much better writer, journalist at UNC Asheville, very proud alumnus there. Bob, he's run the gamut. I mean, he's written about the true pioneers in golf, on the black golfers, all the way to Tiger and Earl. Fascinating. I mean, Tiger and Earl are always going to get they're the stars. Tiger's the star. Fascinating to hear some of his stories about those times with Tiger and with Earl, who he really liked.
Yeah, he really did. And that's probably the greatest compliment that Pete could ever get. I mean, Tiger could write with anybody, obviously, but he chose Pete McDaniel. And to me, you know, that's as good as it gets.
Right. Not only did he, right, Bob, not only the book that he did that he co-authored with Tiger and that he co-authored with Earl, but he ghostwrote lots of instruction articles for Tiger over the years for Golf Digest, did a lot of pieces on him for Golf Digest as well as Golf World. I want to spend a second, though, Bob, and talk about really what was a really sad time in the history, not only in golf, but in the history of this country. The PGA of America, an organization of which I've worked and very, very proud of, unfortunately, and not unfortunately, in a very bad way, from 1934 to 1961, they had a Caucasian-only clause in their membership, which meant if you were black, you couldn't be a PGA professional. They finally lifted that at the 61 PGA annual meeting. Fortunately, gone on and we're seeing more blacks playing the game and wish we had more African-Americans on tour, but that's something that Pete talks about. But I was at the 2009 PGA annual meeting, Bob. It was in New Orleans. And it was as emotional a morning as you will ever find. It was very personal for me. My dad, Max Elbin, past president of the PGA, had passed away in December of 2008. And the PGA of America, at its next annual meeting, honors a fallen past president with a lovely video tribute. Not only was it a beautiful video, Jim Nance voiced it. My daughter, Megan, surprised me with a stirring song of the Josh Groban single, You Raise Me Up. And it was very emotional for those who knew my dad and a lot of tears shed. My mom was there, et cetera. We took a little break. And then Jim Remy, the president of the PGA of America at the time, got up and the PGA was going to posthumously induct three deceased African-American golfers. But Jim figured out something that he needed to say beyond what was scripted. The first thing he said was, on behalf of the PGA of America, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for what we did. We shouldn't have had this Caucasian clause. And Ted Rhodes, John Shippen, and Bill Spiller, three really, really terrific African-American golfers who could not play professionally because of that clause, were posthumously inducted as PGA members. And the great boxer, Joe Louis, who was a tremendous advocate for golf, for the diversity of golf, was posthumously inducted as an honorary member. The emotions that morning, wow, it almost overpowered a lot of people there. And it was all done for the right reasons. And I hope that, I mean, Pete's book has been out for a few years now, but you're going to hear a lot from Pete and his passion about what's happened over the years. I hope you get this book because, Bob, it's meaningful. And I think anything having to do with the history of our country is important.
Very well said, Kelly. And, you know, it was a big dark cloud that was lifted over the PGA of America when blacks were finally admitted. And it was a great day, and it should be celebrated almost on a weekly basis.
Yeah, I agree. I think those are lovely words. There's a dark cloud that I have had to deal with, by the way, the past couple of days in a very different way. You know, I had a lot of fun talk, Bob, about my Washington Commanders going into the NFC Championship game. But there's a really bad word in the NFL. It's called turnover. And if you turn over the ball, particularly to good teams, not just once, but four times, you have no chance. And kudos to the Philadelphia Eagles. Not exactly my favorite team, by the way. But kudos to them. They demolished Washington, took advantage of all those turnovers, and they're on to play the Chiefs. And they better play their A game because, Bob, somehow, some way, Pat Mahomes and the Kansas City Chiefs just keep getting it done as they look for a three-peat.
Yeah, I can't help but think right now, Pat Mahomes is the Tiger Woods of the NFL. I mean, he just seems to do the right thing at the right time. It appears that he does it without even thinking. It's instinctive, which is an incredible feat under all that pressure. But we got a good Super Bowl coming up, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think so, too. And at the point there, Bob, think about how many more major championships Phil Mickelson, Ernie Els likely would have had it not been for Tiger Woods. And I'm sure that Josh Allen of the Buffalo Bills and Lamar Jackson of the Baltimore Ravens, they're kind of feeling like, man, we're Phil and Ernie. We got a couple, but they did. But Jackson and Josh Allen, they haven't even gotten to the big stage yet because of Patrick Mahomes. He's quite the force, isn't he?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine because they're such talented players in their own right. But it's one of those things. Like you said, and very well said, by the way, you know, what would Ernie have won? What would Phil have won had there not been a Tiger? But that's the way it goes.
It is indeed. I was up at the PGA show in Orlando for a day. We're going to talk about more about that on the other side of the interview. Really excited to see our friends, our corporate partners, William and Harry and Titleist. It was a really good 3 days for the PGA show. And you're going to hear spots from them right now. Then you're going to hear a terrific interview with Pete McDaniel right after that here on Musings on Golf. Our friends at William and Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William and Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G, for a 15% discount at williamandharry.com.
You flew the trap on 6. You birdied 12 and 13. You closed out the match 4 and 3. From your numbers to your windows, everything was dialed. That was yesterday. Outperform your best. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Bob, recently we celebrated the extraordinary life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and our guest today is someone who certainly knows the story. of African-American pioneers in the 20th century. With his focus on golf and talent as a writer and author, Pete McDaniel has chronicled the powerful story of Black golfers throughout the past century, from such notable figures as John Shippen and Bill Spiller, all the way to a young kid from Southern California by the name of Tiger Woods. He was a longtime senior writer for Golf Digest and Golf World, and we're thrilled to welcome him to Musings on Golf. He's the pride of Arden, North Carolina. Pete McDaniel, how are you?
Doing great, guys. How are you all?
Here we go. You all. You're getting me to be a Southerner, Pete.
You know what I do? Wait. It's always been a Southerner. What are you talking about?
Pete. And I do be. I want to say something to Pete. And I've known him 30 years, and I've never said this to him, to his face. But I will say that Pete McDaniels is the greatest combination of faith and golf riding ability that's ever walked the face of this earth. Pete, you are so talented, and your faith is so strong. You're just an absolute inspiration.
Thank you, Bob. That touches my heart and my spirit. And before we begin, on that note, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the loss, the recent loss, the passing of two of my colleagues, Jeff Babineaux and Steve DiMeglio. Great guys, great writers, and they will be extremely missed from the golf scene. I just had to say that.
Well, you guys spent a lot more time around both Jeff Babineaux and Steve DiMeglio than I did. My time at the PGA of America, I would see those guys a few times a year. But, Pete, to your point, some people in life, right, and certainly with Babs, he was just always had that great spirit about him. And then with Steve, you know, saddled with cancer those last couple of years, and darn if he didn't talk about it, bravely face it, and you talk about an inspiration to the end. I know you were really, really touched by that. And I'm touched, frankly, by you bringing it up. I think it's fantastic to honor those guys.
Well, I appreciate that. But, you know, every word I say is true, straight from the heart, like Bob said. I am a man of faith. And we were blessed to have those two gentlemen, you know, around us in the media center and out on the golf course. And they inspired a lot of people, for sure.
You know, Pete, it's funny because you take certain things for granted, and it'd be very easy to take for granted walking into a media center and seeing Bab and seeing Steve. And now that we don't have it, we come to the realization how great it really was. I mean, you know, we can't take things for granted in this world. We only have today. We got to do the best we can with whatever we have for today, move on, continuing to cover this wonderful sport.
Well said, my friend. Well said. Absolutely.
Pete, question to get kind of get things started. I noted you're having written one of the great books, really, I think, in the history of golf, not just in terms of covering the history of blacks in golf, Uneven Lies. The heroic story of African Americans in golf. You've written new books, two bestsellers, one with Earl Woods, one with Tiger himself. And I'm wondering, as a kid who grew up at a tough time for blacks in North Carolina, how did you get started in golf, playing golf? I know you caddied some. Kind of give us a background of how you got the golf itch as a kid.
I grew up as an athlete. I played basketball, baseball, football, anything with a ball. And I never will forget, you know, we worked in the summertime. We did various jobs. And this particular summer, my older brother, Randy, and some cousins got a job caddying at Biltmore Forest Country Club. I was 11 years old. You had to be 12 to be able to caddy there. And they came home with some folding money. And I saw that money, and I begged my parents to let me go, you know, get some of that. And they did. And I started out as a shag boy. Yeah, and I'm sure your viewers and listeners know what a shag boy is. And within a year, I was carrying one golf bag on the hilly Biltmore Forest golf course that was designed, by one of the great golf course architects, Donald Ross. And within 2 years, I had advanced to become an A caddy, a class A caddy. And I caddied for the club champion, a guy named Charlie Owen. And so I became pretty good at reading greens and clubbing my player. I thought I was a good enough player. I played also, started playing junior golf. And I got in at playing golf because one day, one of the old members at Biltmore Forest Country Club gave me four wooden shafted golf clubs and said, "Here, young man, take these and see what you can do with them." And so that's how I started playing. And within a few years, I was playing junior golf and competing against some of the best juniors in Western North Carolina. So that's how I got into the game. Yeah. Played high school golf, college golf, and thought I was pretty doggone good, you know, feeling myself, you know, and started playing in tournaments around Asheville, including one called the Skyview Open as a junior player. And the first time I drove up to the Muni for the Skyview Open, I saw this line of cars, these fancy cars, line the highway on the way up to the golf course. And when I got up to the clubhouse, there were these about a dozen colorfully clad players, black players, who were hitting practice shots, warm-up shots before the round. And I stood there behind them, and I watched them hit these little bullets. They all hit little tight draws. And I knew then that, I didn't think that it would be possible for me to progress in the game to that level. So it was at that point that I said, I'm going to continue to play, and maybe I'll dream about playing. But realistically, I'll probably be a better writer than I'll be a player. And that's when I probably made the decision that I'd write about it instead of trying to pursue a career as a player.
And those a couple of those guys were the brothers Thorpe, Jim and Chuck, right?
Jim and Chuck Thorpe, Jim Dent, James Black, Bobby Strobel, you know, all iconic names in the black golf scene. Yeah. Great players. George Johnson, you name it, Nate Starks, all of these guys came through Asheville to play in the Chitlin Circuit event. Yeah.
Well, you know, I know one thing, Pete. A lot of people would have enjoyed you playing golf, but not nearly the number that have enjoyed you writing about golf. You have just an amazing connection to the game. Let me ask you this. Pete McDaniel, how did it come about, your relationship with Earl and Tiger?
Oh, man, now that's one of the great stories that I tell. I've told it many times. I was working for Golf World magazine. I had come from a New York Times own newspaper in Hendersonville, North Carolina, sports editor there. And I got a job with Golf. I actually auditioned and got a job with Golf World, which was owned by the New York Times company. And that was in 1993. Well, in 1994, I was covering colleges and the LPGA, and I had a TV column for Golf World. Tiger was named Golf World's Man of the Year because he had just won the first of three consecutive U.S. Amateur Championships. And I got the assignment. It was a cover story, my first cover story. So I fly out to Stanford to interview him, and I've got this long list of questions. I'm prepared, you know. And he meets me at the golf course, and I'm firing these questions off at him, and he's giving me one-word answers, yes, no. And occasionally he would look up from his breakfast, a stack of pancakes about so high, and he'd say, "What do you mean by that?" So after about 5 minutes into this interview, I have absolutely nothing. So I'm saying, "Oh, my gosh." And then finally, I ask him something. And he looks up at me and smiles, and he started giving me some really insightful answers. We finished the interview. He goes down to the practice range, and he starts hitting golfs and trying to impress me, you know. But I'd seen, I was a big fan of Jack Nicklaus and Lee Trevino and Arnold Palmer, and I'd seen the greats play already. And so I wasn't easily impressed. So anyway, I go back to the office. I write this cover story. Telephone rings, and it's Earl Woods. And he said, "Pete, you did a great job on my on the story on my son. How busy are you?" I said, "Well, Earl, you know, I'm covering the LPGA. I'm covering the colleges. You know, got a TV column." I asked him why. He said, "Well, I was thinking about writing a book, and I thought I might ask you to help me write." I said, "On second thought, Earl, I'm not that busy." We collaborated on training a title. And that's how we formed a friendship, a bond, and it extended into my being the ghostwriter for Tiger. I collaborate on all of his instruction articles with Golf Digest. That's the story.
Amazing. What was Earl like? I mean, there's been, I've heard and read, I never met the man, heard and read so many stories. What was he like for you dealing with him as a from a professional standpoint and a personal standpoint?
Master psychologist. That was Earl. He and I were very good friends. As a matter of fact, I eulogized him. I was one of the people who eulogized him at his funeral. He was a very brilliant man, very articulate, well-schooled, well-versed, and he knew a lot about history. He understood the history of baseball, football, as far as it pertained to African-Americans and other minorities in the sport. And he was raising, intent on raising, a champion in golf and life as he rode in Training the Tiger. And that was his single purpose in life at that particular point in his life. He devoted all of his time to Tiger and his training and his education as far as schooling him on the ways of the world, which is very important if you're a black youth in this country. But he was, he had a crazy sense of humor. We would spend sometimes hours on the telephone just telling stories and laughing. Very sincere individual. And if you had a friend in Earl Woods, you had a real good friend. We were friends to the end. And he believed in work. You know, he wanted you to, if you were collaborating with him on something, you had to be on time and you had to be ready, prepared to write. And, very meticulous individual, but also easygoing. He had this easy way about it. And he had so much faith in his son's ability that he would tell me, "Pete, you look worried. Don't worry, you know." He just was relaxed all the time when it came to watching his son play. He advised any fan of Tiger's just have faith. He knows what to do. And Tiger always, always came through, just like Earl said he would. Yeah. Great guy.
Bob, one more follow-up on that, if I may. Pete, you know, we hear and read all the time about helicopter parents, and they won't let go of their kids and so forth. Earl always struck me as the guy who wasn't that guy. Yes, it was, as you said, it was his goal in life, but Tiger became his own guy. I mean, it always seemed to me, is that a fair statement that Earl sort of understood, I got to get my kid to this point, and then it's up to him. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. Earl would dangle the carrot. He used golf as a carrot, you know, for Tiger, and he inspired him to be great. He inspired him to be the best. Tiger was a workaholic, and that's what people don't understand. Earl never forced Tiger to go play the game. He gave him an example. Tiger just fell in love with the game. And here's the key to Tiger Woods, in my opinion. Sure, he was blessed with certain gifts, you know, certain talents, but that work ethic was inspired by Earl. And the mental capacity to outthink other opponents I believe a lot of that came from Earl and Earl's wife, the Tiger's mother, Cotita. But no, he dangled that carrot and Tiger grabbed it and he ran with it. He is the product of two loving parents who wanted the best for him. And you know, he was never pushed into doing anything. Never has been. You can't push Tiger, would you? You've met him, you know? Have you, anyone who's met him knows that you can't force Tiger to do anything. It just doesn't happen. And I'll tell you another thing. His son, Charlie, looks like he's going to be a clone of Tiger the same way. So, yeah, it's Tiger has his own man, always has it, as far as I'm concerned.
Hey, Pete, do you really think there can be another Tiger in Charlie?
I speak to Charlie's grandmother quite frequently, and she believes that he is the only person alive who can challenge his father's records. I had an inside seat to all the incredible shots that Tiger hit, and all the incredible comebacks and the records that he set. It would be almost impossible for anyone to achieve the kind of success that he did. Can Charlie be a great champion? Yes. But I don't think there'll ever be another Tiger Woods. I just don't see it.
No, certainly a point well taken. You know, I've known you a long time, and I don't think I've ever shared this story with you. I'd like you to hear it. It's kind of like the other side of Tiger. You know, he had his tournament out at Sherwood every year, and my partner, who you know very well, Janice Self, we would cover it religiously year after year. And then all of a sudden, I had to go into the hospital back in New York for a routine examination, and I couldn't go to Tiger's tournament. But Janice decides to go, and she wasn't there long when Tiger sees her. He says, "Janice, where's Bob?" And Janice says, "Oh, he's in the hospital in New York, Tiger. Just a routine examination. He's really fine." Tiger says, "Get him on the phone." So I'm laying in the hospital in New York. Phone rings. I say, "Hello." He says, "How you doing, man?" I said, "Who's this?" He says, "How you doing, man?" I said, "Who's this?" He said, "It's Tiger." I said, "Damn, Tiger, you trying to give me a heart attack?" He said, "No, just wanted to make sure you're doing fine." "I'm doing great, Tiger. Thanks for the phone call." I say to the nurse, "That was Tiger Woods on the phone." She says, "Just wait right here, Mr. Bubkett." She goes and gets a doctor and says, "Doctor, I think Mr. Bubka is being delusional. Would you go in there and see him?" So the doctor comes in and says, "I understand you've been talking to Tiger Woods." "I sure have. He wanted to see how I was doing." And the doctor got the greatest kick out of that of all time. But that was the other side of Tiger that a lot of people didn't get to know. Very caring, and you had the ability to bring those attributes out better than anybody else that ever lived.
Thank you so much for that story. That kind of is in line with the Tiger that I know. I miss a lot of things about covering professional golf, especially Tiger, following him for all those years. You know, I miss seeing him hit great shots. I miss seeing him, you know, rally from behind. I miss the camaraderie among my media friends. But the one thing that I miss most of all is that every time Tiger would see me at the tournament, when he would first see me, he would come up to me and give me this great big bear hug. And he would take my hand and palm it and pull it close to his and ask me how I was doing. That's what I miss. That's what I remember. A lot of the shots will fade away. You know, a lot of his trophies, and you know, I have pictures of me and him. And that's what I'll remember. That's what I take away from the game.
Good memories. Good memories.
It's a great. Absolutely.
Having such a cool visit with the great Pete McDaniel, one of the great golf writers of all time, here on Musings on Golf. And Pete, I know Bob and I want to ask you a little bit about Uneven Lies, but let's maybe like put a little bow on the Tiger talk here. I'm wondering, just strictly from your perspective, and that's a really cool anecdote in terms of hugging you and asking you how you're doing. You've known him a long time, and how do you describe the changes in him as a man, and which he is now, from really a young guy when he started on tour, blasting onto the tour, winning the Masters in record fashion, all the way to today, Pete, where he truly is kind of the elder statesman of the game at 49. I mean, the evolution, we know that off the course, there's been some, certainly been some issues, but as a player and as it really is kind of a mentor almost to the other guys, it has been quite the evolution, hasn't it?
The maturation of Tiger Woods. You know, it's like all of us. We start out young, we're brash, we think we can conquer the world. And Tiger saw everyone as a challenge, you know, and that's how he was taught, to be quite honest. And he was taught that by not Earl, but his mother. His mother taught him. You've heard this story. You probably heard other golf writers say how his mother would teach him to, would prepare him for combat, which was what it was when he was playing junior golf, you know. You go in there with the intention of stepping on their throats. And once the competition is over, you shake their hands and, you know, and then you you go on to the next victim, if you make sure. Yeah. And that was his mentality. He was not going to befriend anybody. He wasn't there to make friends. You know, they were competitors, you know, and he was out to beat them up as badly as he could beat them. And that was his mentality. Away from the golf course, they might have drink a beer or you know, have some friendly banter. But inside those ropes, Tiger was a gladiator, and that's how he treated most of his friends. Now, you know, he is an elder statesman. He's a leader in the game. They look to him to lead them, and he has taken upon that role, you know, exceptionally well as far as I'm concerned. So, yeah, he's more of a big brother now than an opponent.
Yeah, I mean, he really is. Okay, Uneven Lies, the heroic story of African-Americans in golf. You wrote that, researched that. What inspired you to dig deep into the stories of the Bill Spillers and the Joe Louises, let's be on the great, the boxing legend, his role in raising the profile for African-American golfers? Why did you decide to do it? And maybe also, Pete, cite a couple of examples of the challenges, the terrible challenges that African-American golfers faced during that Jim Crow period.
Yeah, well, it was actually before the Jim Crow period.
Yeah, true, yeah.
It was actually beginning in 1934, actually before that, because, but in 1934, there was this addition to the PGA of America's bylaws, quote unquote, the Caucasian only clause was inserted into the bylaws. And it basically said that only white males could join the organization and participate in their events, which it excluded all minorities and women. A lot of people don't realize that, you know. So all of the players who came into the game, all the minorities who came before it was rescinded in 1961, could only play in certain events, you know, a U.S. Open occasionally on the tour, but mostly in black golf tournaments, which were open to everybody, okay? I came up during the Jim Crow era, you know, in North Carolina. I was a little country boy who was forced to go to a white school, an all-white school in the seventh grade because integration demanded it. And I personally experienced all the challenges that integration caused, you know. But so I could relate to all these golfers like Ted Rhodes, like Bill Spiller, like Charlie Sibbert. But what really got me was when I read Charlie Sibbert's book, Just Let Me Play, the most impactful book that I had ever read. It was about his attempt to play on the PGA Tour. And that's where I learned a lot about the struggle. But even before that, I'd heard some of the caddies at Biltmore Forest Country Club talk about a guy named John Brooks Dendy, who was the locker room attendant. John Brooks Dendy was this robust fellow, very friendly guy, but could be stern as well. And I found out what a great golfer he was. He won the Negro National Open Championship 3 times. I asked, well, why didn't he play on the tour? Well, you couldn't play on the tour back then. That's what the other caddies, the older caddies told. And so that planted a seed in my head. And then, you know, to go to fast forward, Charlie Sibbert's book, it's kind of stuck in my craw. Why couldn't we play, you know, with the best players in the world? And that's when, I felt like somebody had to tell the story. Well, actually, Dr. Calvin Sinnott told the story first, a year before my book came out, you know. And that provided more impetus for me to further, you know, tell the story. And so that's how it came about. I signed a deal with Titleist, FootJoy, Wally Uline. Felt that the story needed to be told, and he's the one who backed the book and full support of it. And you know, it is probably the greatest piece of work that I've done in my lifetime. It means the most to me.
Sure.
Because we all human beings and we deserve opportunities, you know. And the playing field had been so uneven for so long that someone needed to tell a story so the masses could understand what had happened in the game of golf and how it needed to be changed. And that's what caused me to champion that cause, you know. And I'm still championing it to this very day because there have been some changes. We've made some progress. But the great cause that I had that I particularly believe I failed at was to increase Black participation in the media. And this is the untold story. For years and years and years, I was one of the few who covered golf for a major publication. I championed that cause around the world, spoke to students, spoke to golf groups, trying to open the door so that more of us would be in mainstream media.
Yeah.
And to this day, we have maybe a couple, but there should be many more. When you have Tiger Woods as the greatest champion for like 3 decades, and you don't see a number of Blacks representing a major media, there's something wrong with that picture. When you look on TV, you watch TV, and you only see a sprinkling of Black golfers, there's something wrong with that picture in 2025. I'm proud to say that the Advocates Pro Golf Association Tour has opened up some doors for Blacks. So some change is going to happen. But to me, it's so doggone slow. It's taking too much time. Bob and I wanted to see it in our lifetimes. You know, I'm recasting aspersions against our age. But Bob, how do you feel about it? Do you think it's going to happen in your lifetime?
Great question.
Well, you know, if anybody's been the pioneer for that, it certainly has been you. I'm proud to know Pete McDaniels. I watched him. I watched how Tiger reacts with him. I watch how other reporters react with Pete. He demands utmost respect and he's earned every single bit of it. And we're thrilled, I mean thrilled, to have him here on Musings on Golf.
You use the word fail. I don't know. I can't speak to, I mean, you're saying that about media members, but I'm kind of like you. I'm befuddled, frankly, by there just aren't any black players on the PGA Tour. I mean, they're just not out there. That, to me, as the most visible form of in golf. I mean, media is one thing. That's fine. And I get it. But they're just not out there, Pete. I can't figure that out. The opportunities have had to be there to raise that number. Or am I missing something?
Well, there are two or three regulars on the PGA Tour. And, right, of course, there's one on Liv, and that's a whole other story that we can talk about another day.
Right.
The opportunity, here's the way I see it. We started so far behind, you know. When you look back at the history of golf, a lot of the players grew up in the game. You know, some were tutored by their parents. Some of them had exceptional coaching and opportunities to play great golf courses, join country clubs. You know, so there was this period of growth that was sustained throughout the years. Well, we were introduced to the game through the caddy ranks for the most part, you know. With the advent of the golf cart, you know, that pretty much took care of the caddy ranks. So if your parents didn't play, normally you didn't play. You know, you played other sports, basketball, football, baseball. By the way, the same things happened with baseball as well, as you can see.
True.
If it's baseball, yeah. And I think that's where the challenge has been for years now. I'll use this track analogy. If you start 10 yards behind the starting blocks, okay, it's hard for you to win a race.
Yep.
It's hard for you to even catch up in a race. So, and I think that's what happened in the game. Now, like I said, the powers that be, the PGA of America, the PGA Tour, the USGA, are now creating some programs. They're getting together with major corporations, and they're trying to make up a lost ground. And I applaud them for that. You have individuals like Steph Curry, Sam Perrier at Howard University. These people are dedicated to leveling the playing field and bringing more players, more minorities into the game. But it seems like we take one step forward and two steps back. And like I told Bob, I don't know if it's going to, I would love to have seen it in my lifetime, but I'm getting old in the tooth. Maybe it will happen. Maybe we'll see maybe a half dozen to a dozen, minority players, black players in particular, on the PGA Tour and the LPGA. The LPGA is worse than the PGA Tour. And that is unbelievable because there are some pretty doggone good, young, African-American, women playing this game. So I'm hopeful. I can't help but be hopeful. My faith tells me that in God's time, which is not our time. So I remain hopeful, but, and there are no buts. I'll remove the but. I remain hopeful.
And I know for one, you have a pretty strong connection with the man upstairs. So you praying on it can do nothing but expedite your wish to come true. And it's my wish, too.
Thank you, Bob. I appreciate that. All we can do is believe. You know, we have to believe that there'll be changes in the world. You're a good man. You all are just wonderful people. I'm proud to know you as well, Bob.
Thank you, Pete. That means a lot to me.
Well, we're standing on, I think, the 18th tee, maybe putting out on 17 green with the great Pete McDaniel. So we've got a couple questions left. I always ask the question about a dream foursome. But before we get to that, Bob, you and I are talking to a Hall of Famer here. So not only is Pete McDaniel a proud Bulldog, a proud alum of UNC Asheville,
Last year, he was inducted into the UNC Asheville Athletics Hall of Fame as a contributor. Pete, how cool was that?
Gosh. Well, I had my children there. I had a grandchild there. I had a significant other there. It was just an amazing event for me. I was so proud. I am proud to this day. I love my alma mater. Few people know that I lasted 1 year playing basketball, and I played on the golf team 2 years. But the experience that I had there was far greater than just in the classroom. It's a liberal arts school, and it taught me a lot about life and how to deal with certain situations and history, and how to achieve. And so I owe a lot to my alma mater. I really do. And to be inducted into the Hall of Fame, I wasn't the greatest basketball player. Let's just put that out there. But I was a pretty good competitor. And I was a competitor in the classroom. And to be among some of the greatest athletes in school history, some of whom I played basketball with and golf with, is an honor that I don't take lightly. For everyone who has attended a mid-major school, not a Duke, not a Carolina, not a major university, but a mid-major. I represent that guy, that young lady, because you can achieve great things with an education from a mid-major just as you can from a power company school. So, yeah, it's one of the greatest honors of my life, no doubt.
Speaking of great honors, Kelly, it's certainly a great honor to have Pete with us on Musings on Golf. And I know Kelly wants to find out your dream foursome there, Pete McDaniel. So let's get to that.
Yeah, Bob and I have had so much fun with this question. And Bob, you and I know also that this question has brought out some different emotions and then the variety of answers. So, Pete, it's a fairly simple question. Who would be the three people, living or deceased, for you who would round out a dream foursome of golf, and where would you play that kind of one magical round of golf, those 18 holes?
You know, I've thought about this as I knew that you were going to ask me this, and I've had a chance to think about it. My dream foursome would be my brother, Randy. Lives in Seattle, and he is a victim of two amputations now. But he and I used to have so much fun on the golf course. I'd love to be able to play another round of golf with him. It's impossible now, but I'd just love to play with him. I'd have to include Tiger Woods in that foursome, because people always ask me, have you ever played with Tiger? No, I played in front of him. I played behind him. I played with Earl many times.
Never
played with him, no.
I'm
afraid I might not even be able to get the ball off the tee. I'd be so intimidated. Although he and I trash-talked enough that I probably trash-talked him into maybe in one or two good shots. And I'd have to say, the last member of that foursome would probably be Lee Trevino.
Wow.
I know that sounds strange, but the first minority that I saw win a major championship and take down my idol, who was Jack Nicklaus, was Lee Trevino. His swagger, his demeanor, He didn't take the game that seriously, or he always carried himself like he was just a swashbuckling, just a carefree individual who came from nowhere, absolutely nowhere, against all odds, and became one of the greatest golfers ever. I'd love to play with him. Yeah, that would be my foursome. Yeah.
And where would you go? Where would you tee it up?
My old course back home, Asheville Municipal.
Love it.
Which took a real severe hit by Helene. But I'm sure it could be restored. It will be restored someday. And I'd love to go to that golf course and see what I could do with those guys.
Yeah. And maybe Mr. Trevino would bring that Dr. Pepper bottle just for old time's sake as well, right?
Wouldn't that be great?
Well, I'll turn it over to you to wrap it up with our good friend.
Well, you know, we've had a lot of guests on Musings on Golf, and it's never easy to say goodbye. But with Pete McDaniel, it's much more than that. He's been a friend. He's been a contemporary. He set me straight whenever it needed to be set. And I admire him. I respect him, and I thank him for golfers all over the world for his contributions to this wonderful sport. Pete McDaniel, you're a true gentleman.
Thank you so much, Bob. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Just like you, I want to look good and perform at my best on the golf course. And that's exactly why I wear the new WH golf shoes from William & Harry, and you should too. Folks, I love these golf shoes. They're made of deer skin and calf skin. They've got a soft gel insert, and the reinforced hardened soft spikes increase stability and balance. And I got to tell you, they are so incredibly comfortable. So head on over to williamandharry.com to check out the new WH golf shoe. Look your best, play your best with William & Harry. Well, I'm really glad we had Pete on. I hope that the passion that he brings about those who have, you know, given so much to the game, for African Americans and who have cared so much for the game through the history of it. I hope you buy the book. If you don't, fine. But I think we all learned a lot from Pete.
Oh, you can learn a lot from Pete. I remember almost the first day I met Pete. I was so impressed with his mannerisms, with his intelligence, with how he conducted himself. Pete McDaniel is first class, first class. That's about as first class as you can get.
Well, Bob, and I thank Pete very much for joining us. A few items, Bob. A lot of respect for Dottie Pepper. We've had her on our show before. She's terrific as a commentator for CBS. And frankly, I'm glad that she really let it out when it came to the slow play that's been a major problem. And I'm really concerned about the PGA Tour in a lot of ways, Bob. You can't have your final group of the day at the event last week go out and play in 3 hours on the front nine and 5 hours and 45 minutes overall. It's a killer for TV. It's bad for the game. I'm happy for Harris English and so forth and so on. But slow play, and it trickles down, Bob, to the colleges. It trickles down to everyday play. It's bad for golf. And it is at this time when the PGA Tour needs to do a lot more to engage with fans. It's not what it needs.
Slow play has been a plague of golf for a long time. Nobody likes to play behind a slow player. And it's just a lot more fun when the game moves along quicker.
When I see some of the different putting things, aim point and so forth, it bothers me. I was encouraged to see the letter that Justin Thomas wrote to his peers, really asking guys, look, maybe it's not the most comfortable thing that you're going to do, but you need to maybe come out of your shell a little bit. You need to be more engaging. You need to be a little bit more fan friendly. I think that's really important. Bob, ultimately, for the people who go and the people who watch on TV, it's entertainment. You know, and the more that the players are approachable, likable, et cetera, the better the game is. I would think you would side with that. It's pretty basic, and yet sometimes that gets lost.
I certainly do side with it. The players could make a greater effort
to be friendlier with the fans. That's what they come there for. That's what supports the PGA Tour, and we need to see more of it.
Let's hear from Harris English. And this was the first time that he was going into the final round with the lead, and let's hear how he dealt with it.
That was the first time I've slept on a lead in a long time. I don't really know if I've done that in my PGA Tour career. But it's never easy. You think it would get easier being in those positions a lot and winning four times out here, but it never gets easier. I knew it was going to be tough today. I love that. I love this golf course when it plays really tough. I knew with the wind, you're probably not going to get somebody that shoots. I saw Sam Stevens shot 400 today, which is an incredible round, but you're not going to really see somebody coming up and throwing a 65, 66 out there today. So as a leader coming to the final round, you kind of like that, but it's going to be grind and you're going to miss fairways, miss greens, but you got to miss them in the right spot. And I kind of leaned on my putter. Had that thing for a long time and started putting with it my senior year of college in 2011. And haven't putted well the last couple weeks in Hawaii and Palm Springs last week, but I worked a lot more this week and I felt like my speed was really dialed in and every putt was going in at the right speed. And it's nice when you hit it to 40 or 50 feet a few holes and can get it up there to tap in distance. So that really won me the golf tournament.
Yeah, that always helps, Bob. When you have those 40 or 50 footers and you knock it up to tap in range, that's when you're very comfortable, I think, playing on the PGA Tour. Otherwise, it can be a real grind.
Yeah, it's a real pressure remover. Get it up there in comfortable distance. Doesn't have to be a foot, but 2 feet, 3 feet.
Yeah.
Something that you feel very comfortable with and you have the confidence to go up and knock it in. And that's certainly what Harris English did.
So Harris, yeah, it was his fourth win at the Farmers Insurance Open in San Diego. By the way, outside of San Diego, by the way, Bob, in just a couple weeks, they're going back there. As we talked about, the Genesis has been moved because of the fires in Los Angeles to Torrey Pines. So they're back there in just a couple weeks. This week, finally, we get to see Scottie Scheffler had a strange accident cutting his hand on Christmas Day. It's a signature event at the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am. You've got Jordan Spieth and Rory McIlroy and Scottie Scheffler and Justin Thomas and Colin Morikawa and Max Homa. It's a $20 million signature event. You can bet they're all going to be there. It should be a fun week. I always enjoy the Pro-Am aspect of it. I know that the players may not get the biggest thrill out of it, but it's always a fun week, I think.
Yeah, I think the fans really enjoy it. It's been a mainstay of the PGA Tour for a long time.
Hey, three other quick things, Bob. One, as I mentioned before we went to the interview with Pete McDaniel, I was at the PGA show just for a day in Orlando, and that's the largest trade show in the world. You and Janice have been there many times. I was really encouraged. In fact, they had 33,000 attendees from the industry. Great numbers. You could feel it, Bob. You know when you go to that show and the aisles are packed and people are buying and there's just a lot of excitement. And I could feel that just in the day I was there. Spent a lot of time with Rhett Butler at our good friend at William & Harry. We've got a great new line of golf shoes coming out. Really, the colors, just crazy looking good. Titleist has got new golf balls and new products coming out. Spent a little bit of time with them. So really encouraged with them. Bob, the industry has never been healthier, right? From an everyday player standpoint. And I sure saw that just in my few hours in Orlando.
Yeah, William and Harry, they had a lot of attention at their shoe stand. And it's almost sacrilegious to call them a shoe. I mean, it's a design feature to your golf wardrobe. That's what I like to call it.
Love it. Bob, two things before we go. I was caught off guard. I'm sure a lot of viewers to the final round Saturday at Farmers were caught off guard when Jim Nantz talked about Davis Love III having had open heart surgery to replace what he called a leaky valve, something that he said his doctors had monitored for the past decade. The surgery went well. He's targeting the summer to return to PGA Tour champions, 1997 PGA Championship winner, and just an all-around really good guy, Ryder Cup captain twice, Davis Love III. Wish him well, and I know he's in very capable hands as he recovers.
Yeah. Anybody that knows Davis Love likes Davis Love. He's a class act, a class player, and we're certainly proud. I mean, exceptionally proud to have him playing professional golf. He's just one fine person.
Final thing, PGL, tomorrow's golf league. They had the match last night. First time the Tiger and Rory, who really are the ones who spearheaded this whole indoor golf simulator event, they played against one another. And it was good. It was exciting. It went to, what, extra holes or overtime. Tiger's team won. Anytime you have Tiger and Rory, that's good. I still feel like having somebody like Charles Barkley, some sort of entertainer as part of all of this, would sustain the audience. I think the numbers as far as TV ratings on ESPN, Bob, will be good. I just still wonder how sustainable it is. But for at least last night, it was fun.
Yeah, some people enjoyed it more than others.
I understand. I understand. Hey, again, we thank Pete McDaniel. Really enjoyed hearing from him. A lot going on. Hope everybody enjoys the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am. A tease off on Thursday. And I hope you all enjoyed this episode of Musings on Golf for my good buddy, Bob Bupka. Kelly Elbin signing off. Thanks for joining us on Musings on Golf.